Well, it's good to see everybody this morning. Some of you I saw at the period of Bible study. It's good to see everyone that's assembled now for the period of congregational worship. So glad to have the opportunity to be with you again. I believe I would be remiss if I did not again mention how thankful the family and I are to you for inviting us down and letting us come spend the weekend with you and spend time doing what we love to do better than anything else, and that is worshiping our God and looking into His Word. It is a treasure. It is a wonderful thing that's been given to us, and it is indeed a blessing that we can gather as we have this morning to do what we are doing this morning. So looking forward to the next few minutes together with you, hopefully sharing some thoughts with you that will be of a help with you on your walk with God and on your journey toward heaven. I hope and trust that that is the destination you intend for yourself. It's the destination I intend for myself. As a friend of mine once said, I've made up my mind. I'm going. And that's how you get there. Is that first of all, you make up your mind that you want to go and that you're going to do whatever it takes to get there. And so I commend you for your presence here this morning. So thankful already for the acts of worship that we've been able to engage in together. I was just thinking a few minutes ago as we partook of the Lord's Supper. I'd not seen it done that way before, but I really like it. I see people standing up and in so doing, declaring their belief in Jesus as the Messiah and declaring that His sacrifice at Calvary meant something and counted for something in the grand scheme of things. And I'm so thankful to see that wherever I go, I'm among family and I'm among fellow believers who trust the Lord who has made us and has promised wonderful things if we serve Him in this life. So I look forward to sharing some things with you this morning that I hope will be of a help to you. To start things off this morning, I invite you to be turning in your Bibles to the book of Acts, in the 17th chapter. Acts chapter 17 provides the text that is the basis for the thoughts that I want to share with you this morning. The events that are documented here by Luke in the 17th chapter of the book of Acts are taking place during Paul's second missionary journey. I know, I just realized that myself. The question is, where did the preacher leave it last night when he left? I thought I'd left it up here. Sorry about that. I see it right in front of me. See, the first place you should have done was come up here where I'm at and look. Sorry about that. See, this is only half the battle, though. Back home, they've discovered that I've got to remember to turn it on as well, which has been a struggle for me at times. But it's on, and let's try that again. If you didn't hear me before, go ahead and be turning in your Bibles to the book of Acts, chapter 17. The events documented here are taking place during Paul's second missionary journey in the regions of Macedonia and Achaia, the Greek world. And I am confident that they are events that will ring familiar to several people in this assembly, if not most people in this assembly. The chapter opens up with Paul traveling to the city of Thessalonica, where the Jews who lived there, let's just sum it up by saying the Jews who lived in Thessalonica caused quite an uproar in response to Paul's teaching. The end result, verse 10, is that the brethren there at Thessalonica sent Paul and Silas away by night. We're not told why, but I assume most likely it was for their own safety because of the stir that the Jews were causing in response to his teaching. So they travel a little further to the west and come to the city of Berea. And as many people are aware, as verse 11 tells us of this chapter, the Jews of that city were much more reasonable than the Jews of Thessalonica. They were willing to listen to Paul. And then they were willing to look in the Scriptures to see if what he said was true. So the Berean Jews were treating Paul much better. But what happened was the Jews of Thessalonica heard, oh, he's in Berea now. And so they go to Berea and they start causing trouble there. And similar to what happened at Thessalonica, the brethren at Berea sent Paul away to the sea while Silas remained in Berea for a time along with Timothy. For his part, Paul continues traveling and he ends up in the city of Athens, farther to the south.
Paul is in Athens, and he waits there for Timothy and Silas to catch back up with him. While Paul awaited the arrival of these companions, he did what a lot of us would do if we arrived in a new city. He decides to look around. He looks around the city, and what he saw, verse 16 of this chapter, is that this was a city that was given over to idolatry and the worship of false gods. And as a result, the text says that Paul's spirit was provoked within him. You see, it seems Paul had what we might call a godly jealousy that just seemed to be stirred up when he saw other so-called gods receiving the praise and credit that in reality only God alone, only Jehovah alone really deserves. And so Paul could not keep silent in the midst of all this. This godly jealousy on Paul's part, with his spirit being provoked, motivated Paul to action. Now, first of all, it is said that he went to the synagogue there in Athens to reason with the Jews. Of course, at the beginning of the chapter, you can see that that really was his custom anyway. Generally, when he arrived in a city, he would go to the synagogue first. But then in verse 17 of this chapter, it is noted that in addition to his speaking at the synagogue with the Jews, Paul also went out into the marketplace of the city, a much more public setting. And there, of course, he had the opportunity to be heard by a wider audience, including, as the text tells us, certain Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. Of course, those were major schools of philosophic thought. And these philosophers seemed to be intrigued by what this stranger from out of town has to say. And so it is this initial encounter with these philosophers from Athens that gives Paul an opportunity to speak to yet another audience. And so Paul is taken to the Areopagus, or if you're reading from the old King James, Mars Hill. He's taken to the Areopagus and delivers a sermon there in the latter part of this chapter. But they were interested in what Paul had to say when he first went out into the marketplace, in large part simply because it was so unlike anything that they had heard before from any school of philosophical thought that they might have been familiar with. They had not heard the kind of things that Paul was saying to them at this time. We get an idea of how at least some of these men read Paul by how some of them describe him in verse 18, in Acts chapter 17 and verse 18, when it says that some of them said, "What does this babbler want to say?" I'm not really sure why the translators chose that word when they were translating this into English. The word that is actually found in the original language that these men use would be probably more accurately translated as seed picker. What does this seed picker want to say? Well, what does that mean? Well, think of a bird that might travel along during the day and find seeds at different places and pick those seeds up and eat them or whatever. And I wonder if the idea wasn't that these guys were saying that they pegged Paul as someone who had gone along. He'd probably traveled around a lot, and he had. He traveled around before coming to Athens, and he probably picked up a philosophical point or two from this place that he traveled, another point or two from this place that he traveled, and now he's come here to where we are at, and he's trying to impress us with these little nuggets that he's picked up at various places. And for this reason, they read him the way that they do, and I believe this can be seen in what Paul said, or the reason that they read him the way that they do is what Paul said in verses 19 and 20. There, regarding these philosophers who heard Paul, it is written, "And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, 'May we know what this new doctrine is of which you speak? For you are bringing some strange things to our ears. Therefore, we want to know what these things mean.'" So, after hearing a little bit of what Paul has to say, these men tell him, "Boy, you're saying some things we haven't heard before. You're saying some things that sound strange to us. These are ideas that you speak of that we are not familiar with." They refer to it as a new doctrine. Well, clearly it was new to them. And as it turns out, the fact that Paul was saying things that were new to these people, that really is what guaranteed him the opportunity to speak again at the Areopagus. But the Athenians saw that he was saying these things, and they recognized that these are new to us. We've never heard this kind of thing before. And as a result, they want to hear more. And that's because, really, the Athenians, in large part, were attracted to new things. They were attracted to this kind of thing. In fact, if you're there in Acts chapter 17, you might note what Luke writes in verse 21. There he says, "For all the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or hear some new thing." Now, it may or may not have made sense to those who heard him, but because it was something new to them, they were interested and they wanted to hear more. Now, to me, believing the things that I believe and knowing the things that I know, I find it very interesting that these men referred to the things that Paul had been saying as strange to their ears and a new thing. I find that to be very interesting. Just what kind of things had Paul been saying? What had Paul been talking about that struck them as so odd and as so new? Well, of course, we don't have all the details of what Paul spoke about in the marketplace that piqued the interest of these men. But the text does reveal a couple of things. Certainly, Paul spoke about the Lord himself. Verse 18, still speaking of his time in the marketplace, Luke records that Paul had preached to them Jesus. Of course, as you read on down through his sermon at the Areopagus in verses 23 and 24, he spoke to that assembly about the God, well, that most of us are familiar with, a divine being who has created all that there is. In verse 24, Paul notes that this is the God who made the world and everything in it. So Paul talked about a single God who created everything, who is responsible for all that they see and responsible for their existence. And to the pagan ears of this people, who recognized hundreds of gods, this was a strange and new concept. Should it have been? Should the concept of God, the God that is described in the pages of Scripture, the God that Paul serves, should that have been new and strange to anyone? Sometimes I get amused as I get older. I bet some of you do too as well. When I hear younger folks start talking about some new thing that they've discovered, and I realize that's something that I became aware of 30 years ago. It's not really new, but it's new to them. I remember not too terribly long ago being struck by the words of Solomon in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 10. He wrote there, "Is there anything of which it may be said, 'See, this is new'? It has already been in ancient times before us." Of course, one of the major themes of the book of Ecclesiastes is that, in fact, there is no new thing under the sun. As often as not, when people are struck by something new or speak of some new thing, really what they're talking about is the fact that it's something that they were not previously familiar with. It's new to them, though it's not really new. And the concept of the God that Paul spoke of in Athens, that was not some recently contrived idea developed by just another branch of philosophy. It was and had been since the beginning and remains a truth, a reality that has been true ever since the beginning and even before. So it was interesting to me recently to read about this people that had not heard of our God, because I know for a fact that there once was a time when the entirety of humanity was familiar with this God. Now, granted, you've got to go pretty much back to the beginning. But there was a time when everybody knew this God. And I feel comfortable in saying that this would have been true for at least the first few generations of mankind's existence. That at the very least, everybody was aware of this God and knew about this God. But by the time you come to the first century AD, by the time of Paul and his visit to Athens, you've got a group of people here to whom the idea of such a God sounds like a strange thing. But again, getting back to my question, what was Paul talking about that sounded strange? Just this concept of God in general was one of those things, according to the text, that Paul had talked about that some of the Athenians at least found to be a strange thing. And it piqued their interest. Now we can also note that in addition to talking to the people of Athens about God and about Jesus as the God who came and lived in the flesh, well, if you look up in verse 18, for example, you may have noticed that he also spoke to people about the resurrection. How Jesus was raised from the dead, and following from that, very possibly he might have talked about how others will be raised from the dead. That was a common theme of Paul's teaching with regard to the resurrection of Christ. But we know at the very least, he talked about this man, Jesus of Nazareth, who had returned from the dead. Well, this too was an idea. It was a concept that sounded very strange to the people there gathered. Probably even stranger than the idea of this God that Paul would have presented to them. And I say that it may have even been stranger because of their reaction to Paul's teaching about the resurrection. Particularly when Paul spoke at the Areopagus. What you find is that they listened to him up to the point that he talked about the resurrection. It was when he mentioned that at the Areopagus that the whole meeting started to melt down and break apart. In Acts chapter 17 and verse 32, Luke writes, "When they heard the resurrection of the dead, some mocked. While others said, 'We will hear you again on this matter.'" But again, the meeting starts to break down when Paul mentions this notion of returning from the dead. And speaking of there being no new thing under the sun nowadays, someone might argue, and in fact many people have argued, that Christianity is no longer a reasonable belief. Because it is really based upon the foundation of the resurrection of Jesus. And as I've actually heard people say, it's not reasonable to believe, and it's not reasonable to expect people to believe that someone can return from the dead. Now, you might have been able to convince people of that 2,000 years ago, those superstitious people of the first century. They might have bought into that, but nowadays we are more sophisticated and we know better in the 21st century than to think that somebody can return from the dead. The fact of the matter is, people of the first century knew better than that too. And we see that in verse 32 of this text. They knew better than to believe that someone could return from the dead. And it may well be that their reacting to Paul's teaching on this might have been because of their lack of familiarity with the God that Paul spoke of. Now, they listened to Paul talk about God because they accepted the notion of gods in general. They just weren't familiar with Paul's God and his attributes and his power. So the concept of God in general was not so far-fetched, but it was evident that people returning from the dead was really more than many of them could swallow. And my point is that for the person who is familiar with and who is accepting of the reality of the God that Paul knew, this would not be so far-fetched to think that someone could return from the dead. A few pages over in the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 26, as Paul gives his defense before Agrippa, it was just after Paul mentioned Christ's resurrection to Agrippa, and that would be down around verse 23, it was right after that that the Roman official there, the Roman governor Festus, cut Paul off and interrupted him and basically said that Paul was crazy. I do find it interesting that it was right when Paul, or at least as Luke documents it, when Paul mentioned the resurrection that Festus jumps in and says, "Much learning has driven you mad." It does seem that talk of the resurrection is what set Festus off. He wasn't an Athenian, he wasn't a Greek, he was a Roman. But as a Roman, he too was a pagan. He was unfamiliar with this doctrine, and he seemed to think that it was too much to ask of someone to believe. Again, being someone who was not familiar with the God that Paul spoke of. Most of us here, I'm confident really most all of us here, are aware that men cannot revive somebody from the dead. We know that. We know that, but though we know that man is unable to revive the dead, we do not have a problem with the general concept of resurrection because of our belief in the God that the Bible describes to us. We mentioned this in our study last night. What are the first words in the Bible? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And we asked the question last night, why does the Bible begin with those words? Because it's introducing us to the God of the Bible from the beginning. It's God letting us know, this is who I am, this is what I am like. You need to know this up front. There's a reason that the Bible begins with the Creator, the creation account. Because it shows us that our Creator is a being who can do things that we cannot do. I believe this is why Paul, a man who was familiar with this God, said what he did to Agrippa at this time in Acts 26. Agrippa was not a devout man by any stretch of the imagination. Understand that. But he was familiar with the God of the Jews. He was familiar with the God that Paul served. And because Paul knew that he was familiar with this God, take note of what Paul said to him in Acts chapter 26 and verse 28, or verse 8, Acts 26 and verse 8. Paul asked Agrippa, why should it be thought incredible by you that God raises the dead? Now, if I told you that I raised the dead, yeah, you should think that's incredible. Literally, you should think that's not credible. But there's nothing at all incredible or incredulous about acknowledging that God can do this. If you're familiar with this God, you know that nothing is impossible for Him. God could cause a 90-year-old woman to have a baby. What did He tell that woman when she was 89, when she laughed about it? He said to Sarah, is anything too hard for God? That's what you call a rhetorical question, isn't it? You know the answer. No, the answer is no. He said something similar. Well, not God, but His angel Gabriel said something similar to another woman who shouldn't have been able to have a baby. When she was told that she would have a baby, having never known a man, Gabriel reminded Mary, with God, nothing will be impossible. And when God Himself walked on the earth, and Jesus watched that rich young man walk away, Jesus said, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. And the disciples said, well, who then can be saved? Now keep in mind what I believe Jesus was saying here. A lot of people have tried to explain what the eye of the needle was, that it was some hole in the wall of Jerusalem that a camel could only go through with great difficulty. But Jesus was talking of something that was impossible here. When Jesus said it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle, you know what I think He was talking about? I think He was talking about a camel, and I think He was talking about a needle. And what did He say? He said, with men, this is impossible. What did He say right after that? With God, all things are possible. That's the God that we're familiar with. That's the God that Paul was talking about. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that despite the fact that by Paul's day there were many who were unfamiliar with this God, there had been a time, I believe with all my heart, there had been a time, however brief, when this was not so, when all humanity knew of this God. What it does is it speaks to us of humanity's failing, that this familiarity with God was lost for so many. But once again, thinking back to those earlier times, even after many did start to lose familiarity with this God, those who remained familiar with this God had no trouble with the thought of Him raising the dead, even back to the earliest of times. Think of Abraham in this light. We don't read his thinking in Genesis when God told him to offer his son Isaac on that altar. But the Hebrew writer in Hebrews chapter 11 tells us something about Abraham that is very enlightening in this regard. In Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 19, after noting that Abraham's willingness to offer Isaac as a sacrifice on the altar, the writer goes on to note that Abraham had concluded that God was able to raise him, able to raise Isaac, even from the dead. You don't see a lot of talk about this in the Old Testament, I'll grant you that. But the writer here says Abraham knew God could do that. Abraham knew God could raise the dead. And so everything that I've been saying so far has been leading up to what I want to say right now. These men were attracted to what Paul had to say and were willing to listen to him because what he said sounded so strange and new to them. Well, I submit to you that the things that Paul spoke of should not have sounded strange or new to his hearers or anyone else for that matter, because they were not new. Again, in Acts chapter 26, when Festus accused Paul of being mad because of what he taught, Paul responded in that chapter in Acts 26 and beginning in verse 25, "I am not mad, most noble Festus, but speak the words of truth and reason. For the king before whom I also speak freely," talking about Agrippa, "knows these things. For I am convinced that none of these things escapes his attention, since this was not done in a corner." It is interesting to me that Paul effectively cites Agrippa as someone who could vouch for the reasonableness of what he was saying. Because though Agrippa was not a devout man himself, he was familiar with the things that Paul taught and familiar with Paul's God. Because these things had been out there for a long time. They thus should not have seemed strange to Agrippa, and they should not have seemed strange to the Athenians back in our original text. The things Paul taught to those who were gathered in Athens that day should have been already known by everyone, everywhere. These things had been at one time common knowledge among men. Now, it had been a long time since that was the case, I'll grant you that. But it had been the case nonetheless. And it's sad to think that by the time that Paul arrived there in Athens, it was no longer common knowledge. Knowledge of this God and knowledge of what he can do was no longer as common as it once was. The knowledge had not been properly treasured and preserved in the hearts of men. It had not been passed on to their children and to others. And it was thus lost to many. And as knowledge of the true God faded, it was replaced by ignorance and error. Until finally, what was true came to be regarded as a strange sounding doctrine. Strange sounding in the minds of many. And as I think about this aspect of Paul's time in Athens, that it was he was dealing with people that found his teaching to be strange and unfamiliar, I think of how similar is the situation we find ourselves in 20 centuries later. I remember several years ago, I was teaching a class. I used to teach classes at a community college up in Tennessee on the United States. And on American government, I taught government classes. And I remember several years ago, in the course of one of the classes I was teaching, I was talking about the events that led to the rebellion in the colonies, and that led to the American Revolution, and that led to the establishment of the United States and its government. But one of the things that happened between the British government and the Americans struck me as sounding similar to what happened between King Rehoboam and the people of Israel after Solomon died. The American people were pleading for relief from the king, and the king wasn't giving. I thought, well, that sounded like Rehoboam. And I mentioned in my class, you know, they're pleading with Rehoboam for relief after his father Solomon had died. Sounds a lot like what happened between King Rehoboam and the Israelites in the Bible. I mentioned that, and I found myself looking out over a room full of blank stares. Who? What? None of my students knew what I was talking about. They didn't know the events that happened between Rehoboam and the Israelites. And I went ahead and asked, just because I got curious, do any of you know who Rehoboam was? Not a one of them did. He was the son of one of the most famous kings in human history. Nobody knew who he was. knowledge of the Bible, of its people, its events, and its God has become lost to many in our society. Even though, at least in this nation, you can still get a copy of the Bible pretty easily. I know where you can get a copy for a dollar. You got a dollar, you can get a copy of the Bible. If you've got a friend, you can probably get a copy from them if you want one. Most of us have multiple copies. And yet, the knowledge of what is contained within it is being lost. In the days of good King Josiah, and Josiah was a good king, as recorded in 2 Kings chapter 22, the temple, long neglected by the wicked kings that had preceded Josiah on the throne, the temple was finally being cleaned and repaired in his day. And while it was being cleaned and repaired, they found something amazing. You know what they found? They found the book of the law of God. The book of the law was found. Well, what does that suggest then? It had been lost. It had been neglected. It had long been neglected and ignored. And not surprisingly, the people had not been acting in accordance with what it taught. And they even became unfamiliar with what it taught, as seen, I believe, in Josiah's reaction when it was read before him. When the law was read to Josiah, he tore his clothes and he knew, we haven't been doing this. And maybe we read of this and we wonder, this is the book of the law of God given by God through Moses to the people. You know, and the kings had been commanded to write their own copy of it, you know. This is the law of God. How on earth could the people of Israel let it get to the point where it was actually lost to them and its teachings forgotten? Well, look around you at the religious world. People largely stopped reading the Bible a long time ago. I tell people sometimes, I'm kind of an anachronism myself. I love to read. I love books. I mean, reading digital copies, that's fine. I read that too. But I like my, what I call codexes. I like my actual books. And I like to read. You know, most people in our society don't. But here's the deal. If I want to be pleasing to God, I need to be willing to read at least one book. But people aren't doing that. People have largely stopped reading the Bible, and so now we find that much of what the Bible teaches sounds strange to many people. People in Athens found Paul's teaching regarding the Lord and the resurrection so strange to their ears because of the same thing that we're seeing today. Nobody was taking the time to learn it, to study it, and pass it along. The fact is that many people that we come into contact with today still have largely the same reaction to many of the teachings of the Bible. Despite the fact that there is evidence to support the fact that the Bible does teach these things, and despite the fact that there is ample evidence that the Bible is a reliable source of information with regard to God's will. And please take note of this fact about what I'm saying here. I'm not just talking about non-religious people. And I'm not just talking about those who practice what we might call non-biblical religions. No, this sad state of affairs is a reality among people professing to be disciples of Jesus Christ. The fact is, a lot of people who profess to be disciples of Jesus will find what this church teaches and what this church practices to be strange. But I am confident that all this group is trying to do is be like the church that you read about in the New Testament, if you're reading the New Testament. All they're trying to do is do the things that Christians did back then in the way they did them back then. Now, I'm not going to say that any of us have necessarily arrived yet, that we're all that we need to be in that regard. Quite frankly, I think we're all works in progress. And even as a church, we are a work in progress. There's always the need to examine ourselves, to look at the Scriptures and see if we are in compliance. I don't want to present this in an arrogant way. I'm just saying that's what we aspire to. That's what we want to be. We want to be a church that a person from the first century, if they were able, could walk into and recognize what we're doing. And recognize, yeah, this is what we did. But many such teachings and practices have become strange to me, or strange to many professed disciples. Many people in the Christian community today, for example, find that all our belief that really all churches, all local assemblies ought to be practicing the same thing. Unity today is just accepted as, well, we'll agree to disagree and call that unity. No, that's just agreeing to be divided. It's not unity. The idea of Christians in every place doing the same thing would not have seemed strange to first century Christians. It wouldn't have seemed strange to Paul, who wrote to the Corinthian church in 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 17, that he taught the same thing in every church. You think I could get away with that? You think I could go teach the same things in other churches around here that I teach here? I like to think that I could, but I don't think that would fly in a lot of places. Paul also wrote to the Philippian brethren in Philippians 3 and 16 that they all needed to walk by the same rule. They all needed to be of the same mind. I'm telling you what, if you get a baseball rule book and you have different groups of people go set up a game and follow the rules in that book, every one of them will be playing baseball. If we're all following the same source document, we'll be doing the same thing. We will be of the same mind. Now, at one time, insistence in this regard did not seem strange to anyone within the church. But it does now. We might think of other things. We might think of the music of our worship. Many take note of the fact that we do not have instruments of music in our worship here. And many find that to be a strange thing as well. Many will find it to be a strange and new doctrine. It wasn't always that way. It didn't always seem strange to people. Of course, in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 19, as well as Colossians 3 and verse 16, we call them the music passages sometimes. We are told to sing to one another, sing to the Lord, teach one another, with no mention anywhere there or anywhere else in the New Testament of instruments of music. In fact, you may be aware that vocal music, well, how do we sometimes refer to vocal music? What do we call vocal music sometimes? We'll call it a cappella music. And maybe you're aware of this, but that phrase, a cappella, literally means in the manner of the chapel. A cappella, chapel. It literally means in the manner of the chapel or the manner of the church. Because for centuries, after the establishment of the church on Pentecost, it was understood that church music was vocal music. Our insistence in this regard seems strange to some now. But you know, for hundreds of years following the establishment of the church, what would have seemed strange to those people would be adding in instruments. We could say the same thing with regard to other things relative to the church. The works that the church does and does not do. What the church teaches regarding salvation, what the church teaches regarding the need to remain faithful to the Lord in order to go to heaven even after you become a Christian. These things sound strange to the ears of a lot of people, to the ears of a lot of modern religionists. Well, they may sound new, but I submit to you that they're not. And that they sound new simply because people in general have not been spending the time that they should be spending in the Word of God so that they might know what the truth actually is. Think about this. If we were to sum up what it was that sounded strange to the Athenians, you know what we could say? It was the truth that sounded strange to the Athenians. Does the truth ever sound strange to us? Does it ever sound strange to you? Do you know what the truth is? If you're not sure, I know there's several within this assembly this morning who would be perfectly willing and happy to sit down with you and the Bible and make the truth within its pages more familiar to you. And that's important because it's the truth that will make us free. I appreciate your attention this morning. Go ahead and take out your song books and turn to the number that's been selected. I did look this morning. There's water in the baptistry. And so, before we close things out this morning, We want to offer the invitation of the Lord to any who might have need to render obedience to the gospel of Jesus Christ. What I'm about to tell you is a strange teaching to many in the religious world. But Jesus himself said, "He who believes and is baptized will be saved." Have you done this? If you have not and you desire to be saved, that opportunity is before you at this time. You could confess faith in Jesus. We could immerse you in this water for the remission of your sins. You would be a Christian. You would be saved. You would rise to walk out in newness of life out of those waters. If you're a child of God who's done that, but you've drifted from the way, the Lord stands ready to welcome you back into his arms just as surely as that father welcomed his prodigal son home. If you can make it right between you and him privately, then do it. If it's something that requires the assistance of the church, there's nothing that anybody here would like better than to help you get right with the Lord again. There's no need for anyone here to leave here unprepared for eternity. Don't do that. If we can help you get prepared, please let us, even now, as we stand and sing together. Lord.